Now, Tracy covered the first 3 hours on the cross Wednesday night. Now we'll be talking about through Jesus' death and his burial, starting from the hour to the ninth hour. Right, I was thinking noon. That's not right. So sixth hour to the ninth hour. So in terms of the how the Jews kept their time, that would be how we'd be referring to it. Now, I want to back up and touch on a couple of things to set the stage of where we're at. Jesus has been on the cross. He has been nailed to the cross. He's been agonizing there on the cross in pain for a period of space roughly of 3 hours. Now, we know that people have gone past him and they have reviled him. The close of Wednesday night's lesson, we've seen the high priest come by and reviled him and spit on him. And what are some of the things they've actually said to him? If you're the Christ, do what? Come down. And who else picked up on that theme and started reviling at Jesus? The thieves on the cross as well. Except one, you know, sort of had a change of heart. What did he have to say? We're here because of what we've done. We deserve to die, but this man's innocent. Jesus' response to him at that point was what? Day you will be with me in paradise. Interesting. You see the it's hard to say. You can't call him a gentleman. This individual that was on the cross had a change of heart, and as a result of it, showed that to Jesus. And as a result of that, he said, "Remember me." And that's really the appeal with which Jesus responds to. It shows that he's asking for mercy by the only one that really could grant it at that point. He's not going to get it from the Romans. He's not going to get it from the Jews at that point. Okay. We enter the sixth hour. What key pivotal thing starts happening? Darkness. Okay. Are we talking just normal darkness? You know, a thundercloud comes over and it gets dark. Okay. No, it's not. This is something that the people all around begin to notice. This is fundamentally different. What other times have we seen darkness come about? Plagues. And that helps me to think in terms of this as well. The darkness that came about at that point was something that they knew that was unusual, uncharacteristic. We've talked about the parallels between standing in a cave and no light being found. You can't see your hands in front of your face. It was significant enough that they knew this was unusual. What other things associated with just the intensity of the darkness would have also made it unusual? Time of day that it occurred. It started at the midday. It would have been the brightest part of the day. The length of it. This is 3 hours. What's the longest eclipse that you know of? A few minutes. This is not something that just they would be exposed to on a regular basis. This is unusual. And it should set the stage for things to happen or for them to be thinking about. That are going to be coming to pass. What did some of the people surrounding the cross at that time start to notice? Jumping toward the tail end of that period, I want to go ahead and set the stage for it. What did some of the soldiers say? Surely this man was the Son of God. So we see events transpiring that that they can't reconcile. Now, there are other key things that occur during this period as well. Jesus speaks. Several small, short sentences, no doubt strained sentences given his condition, but sentences that needed to have been made. And we see the reaction of the people that are surrounding him, having heard those, and what their thoughts are on that as well. First one, starting in Mark 15:34, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Some of the people surrounding him mistook that to mean what? He's calling for who? He's calling for Elijah. Well, now, why would that have mattered? Who was Elijah? One of the key prophets from old. One of the key prophets that had exhibited the ability to perform miraculous happenings and other things that people would have known him and equated him with the power of Moses and others. Okay, so if they're saying, he's calling for Elijah, so Elijah's going to come and do what? Save him, take him down. We know that's not the case. We also see here that they learn better than that as well. Jesus asked in John 19:28, he makes a statement, "I thirst." Now, in earlier opportunities, Jesus had been afforded the opportunity to drink something. What had been offered him? Wine, a sour wine mixed with myrrh, which would serve as a numbing agent or whatever, but that was the only thing that they were really offering him at that time. He refused it at that time. Now, the Bible does not state why he refused it. People have, one could assume that he had to bear the full measure of the pain of the cross and so on. He had to be clear-headed as well in the statements that he needed to make. We see here we're coming to the end of his period on the cross. But given the amount of time on the cross and the ear dehydration and other things that take place, what can you not do if you are parched? Talk. Mouth's dry, you can't get the words out. Opportunity here, he knows he needs to make some statements. Moistening in his lips, he's moistening his throat in order to be able to get these statements out. It's also completed the task. There's no need for to worry about a numbing agent of any sort of pain. Coming to the last bit of him being on the cross. What did the individuals who heard the statement about him asking for, saying, "I thirst," what did they do? They brought it up to him on a small sponge or something dipped in sour wine on a what? Little reed. Okay. The only reason, the Bible is wonderful in how it points out little bitty things. This gives us an indication of where Jesus' position was. Now, if you were standing there, the type reeds that they would have had at that time, a small hyssop reed, something that's not going to be more than 18 inches tall. So if you're standing here and you're putting this on a small reed and you're lifting it up to someone, not way up high, he's moderately high, but he's high enough up that his lips are not something you can reach, but gives you an indication of if you're trying to explain that to individuals in your class on how Jesus would have been positioned on the cross to get a visual reference, those would be some of the things that give you a sound basis for making that conclusion on. Jesus would have been out of arm's reach to his mouth. Otherwise, they would just lifted it up. They did that on a reed and brought it up to his mouth. Okay. This was a fulfillment of prophecy. Psalms 69:21, "They gave me also gall for my meat, and in my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink." Following in other references, it states that after that, others made the comment about, well, let Elijah come and take him down. So the combination of these two statements together, the people respond back to that. Next statement is a telling statement. John 19:30. It is very end. Now, what's finished? His work on earth. We could narrow it down and say, well, he died. No. There's so much more that is culminated by the statement of these three words. It is finished. The entire timeline as it comes forward, his God's mission of sending him to die on the cross as a sacrifice. Granted, there's more to happen yet. But that sacrifice being set in motion and being in place finished at this point as he gives up the ghost. Now, talk about a timeline here. That's several thousand years. And from that point back, that level of planning from the very beginning, okay, from the very beginning, in the garden, Genesis 3:15, it's that point that's set in motion all the way through and culminated with this statement. It'll be finalized in his resurrection. Twofold. If Jesus dies and nothing else happens, what happens? Satan's victorious. There's nothing there to show God's power over death. Okay? The next statement, "Father, into your hands I give my spirit," is recorded in Luke 23:46. And it simply stated he bowed his head and died. Work on this earth had been complete. God's plan up to this point had been fulfilled and culminated. What happened upon Jesus' death? Now this runs through to the from the sixth hour to the ninth hour, where stating that the end of this darkness is very near the end of the ninth hour. And we see other events start to take place that are triggered with that. What's one of the most notable? The veil of the temple is rent. Okay, now, there's a veil that existed in the temple between what two areas? Holy place and the most holy place. Okay, and the purpose of it was what? In the days of the tabernacle, it was to shield from the presence of God. Who was allowed to go in the most holy place? The high priest. Once a year. Okay? And we're assuming they continued that similar ritual all the way through. You know, the Jews tended to modify things as well, but at that point, it should have been still symbolic of the place in which the presence of God dwells in the most holy place. What's symbolic of the veil being rent? And we know this from other passages as well, but what does it mean when the veil rent? What fundamental things change? Okay. And it separated us from God, and that a sacrifice now had been made, and that there's no separation through that veil anymore. Okay? What other things are symbolic in the tearing of the veil? The old law is going out. It's gone. Okay? What else? I think those are the key points that are important to identify to students, because they need to understand that this is the pivotal point. Changes are in place. I mean, what about a will? Talk about a will and a testament comes into effect. Comes into effect after the death. Okay, change in the law is taking place. Now, there's some subtle things that it says about the rending of the veil. You have curtains in your house, and you see them tear. Where do they normally tear from? Tear from the bottom. Okay, this is a subtle thing. You don't want to make a big point out, a large point out of it. But we talked about the fact that the darkness was an unusual event. It would be an unusual event for the veil to rend from the top to the bottom. You know, somebody could go into the temple and tear the veil from the bottom to the top. They didn't have ladders in there for somebody to go up there and start it from the top and tear it down. It had to be done at the hand hour. Okay. What other things happened that were, I would say, rather notable? Many of the dead saints arose. The Bible is very, and there's no real elaboration on this. We have no indication of what form they appeared in or whatever. We just know that they appeared and they remained with the people. It's not like they just appeared and disappeared. Many of the dead saints arose and went amongst the people and appeared to them. Wow. We thought the raising of Lazarus would be a significant event. You know, Lazarus had been in the grave for a period of 4 days, wasn't he? 4 days. We have no indication of how long these individuals had been in the grave. Okay? Okay? Point. Okay? That's exactly right. Well, there's another event that occurs as well, and what was that? All of these are events that are taking place to show people that it's just not a normal death. It's not a normal individual that has died. Okay? Now, we go forward to the next sequence of things. What did the Jews want to do? They wanted to hurry up Jesus' death. Have the thieves' legs broken primarily because of what? Coming up on the Sabbath. Okay, it was not only the Passover feast, but this was a high feast. It was the Sabbath. Now they wanted to get the thieves down. They couldn't have them hanging on the cross over the Sabbath. So they came and asked the legs of the individuals on the cross be broken, their legs be broken. When they came to Pilate, they asked for permission to do so. He granted that permission. He was informed that Jesus was already dead. He's a bit surprised, you know, by that. But having sent the soldier out to break the legs, what did the soldier end up doing to Jesus? Okay, used a spear and pierced his side. Now, what about the thieves? Okay, they broke their legs. Now, why would you break the legs of someone on the cross? Can't lift themselves up and down, and as a result of that, if they can't lift themselves up and down, they can't breathe because of the pain and the stretching of the abdomen and the pressure that's put on the body as a result of the way they're positioned on the cross. They had to raise themselves up and down to continue to breathe. Once you break their legs, they're not able to breathe anymore. Okay? Okay? The Bible gives us very little detail overall about Jesus other than that his side was pierced, which is fulfillment of prophecy as well. Forthwith came blood and water. Now, I don't think it's necessary to go into great detail on that. There are physiological aspects of that that one could have an entire lesson associated with it if you want physiology of it. But because of the someone in that amount of respiratory distress, fluid builds up around the heart in the form of water and liquid, and that would be as a result of puncturing that sac, that material would come forth. No possibility that an individual had been taken with a spear and pierced in that manner to live. Okay? Puncturing the cardiac sac and so on in that area. So to have someone come along and say, Jesus fainted, doesn't play out. I think that's a key point to make with your students. They pierced his side to ensure that he was dead. And as a result of that, the claims that will be made later that he just fainted aren't true in any manner. Okay? Any comment to this point toward the end of class? I didn't want to devote a lot of time to that, but we will touch on that before the end of class. Okay? Any other questions? Exactly right. You know, the notion that Jesus had fainted is not even on the table for consideration. So. Right. It absolutely made an impression. We see other key individuals coming into this point. We've talked about Joseph of Arimathea before. We've talked about Nicodemus. We see Joseph as a member of the Sanhedrin coming and asking Pilate for the body of Jesus. Joseph is granted permission to take Jesus. And what does Joseph do with Jesus' body? Wraps it up and prepares it for burial. Now, not only did he just do it preparing for burial, Joseph's tomb was a brand new tomb, was one hewn out of stone. It would have been prepared for someone who was of high status, and in the manner that they prepared Jesus' body. Nicodemus brought large amounts of myrrh and aloes and other things to embalm the body with, and prepare the body with, and then wrap it in a white linen. Okay? They take the body, they put it in the tomb. It says that it was a new tomb. And what's important about that? Only the rich could have had that type of tomb, but there's another point. There was no confusion about how many bodies were in there. There was going to only be one. That was going to be Jesus' body. So when you go back into that tomb and there's not a body there, what do you have to conclude? Body's been raised. Okay? It was getting close to that time. Well, I think they hurriedly prepared Jesus' body for burial, but not in the same manner that they would have always wanted to do, and with the level of reverence and respect that they would have always wanted to do. And the women at this time, it's no indication that they were able to come and do that in a manner that they may have done for others customarily. So I think it's an indication they wanted to finish preparing Jesus' body. I'm not saying that they were. There's no indication at this point that they were. I believe that the indication is that Joseph and Nicodemus are hurriedly taking care of this to prepare Jesus for burial before the Sabbath is starting. Doug? Oh, yeah. It was done secretly to Pilate, but it needed to have been done. And I think it's the fact that he did it secretly to Pilate is an indication of that he just didn't make a big noise about it. Anybody that's going to be involved in anything that to do with Jesus point forward is going to be marked by the Jews as a troublemaker, as an insurrectionist, and like the apostles. So he takes this to do this in a way to honor Jesus. Now, Old Testament prophecy talks about how Jesus would be, manner of his death. And see, he was killed with thieves, and yet he was buried with as a king. Being here now, as he goes into this new tomb that would have been prepared for only those of the highest of status and efficient funds to do so, he's buried as a king. Okay. The concern over Jesus' body and what happens to Jesus' body doesn't just end with Nicodemus. There are other individuals that are concerned about Jesus' body. Who might they be?
Jews.
Okay. Why might the Jews be concerned? Okay, they heard what he said, being raised in 3 days. So, okay, you already know that he's dead. So they're not worried. The Jews here aren't worried about Jesus being alive and just hearing, are they? They're worried about somebody coming and stealing the body, and then as a result of that, his disciples being able to claim that he's been raised. Okay? So what did they ask for? Guards. Okay? So, two things were done. One was the tomb was sealed with a Roman seal. And when we think about that and conveying that idea to our students, a Roman seal would have been an instance of taking one's signet ring or whatever, or a signet symbol, and pouring wax over an area and marking it as if something has been sealed. That way, when that seal is broken, there's visible evidence that it has been broken. Like in olden times, you might seal a letter with a wax dot and press a signet over the top of it. Same type of thought process. Here's how the tomb is sealed. Now, what did they set in place over the tomb? Guards. Okay? And that is now in place from that time forward until what event? Okay. Tracy will have that Wednesday night. Now, going back, any questions over what we've talked about this morning? Okay? Right.
Okay.
Correct.
So they better know just like
point. Okay? Any other comments? Okay. Taryn, to go back and address the question about the statement that Jesus made of why has thou forsaken me. We can address that on a couple of different levels. I'll try to do that. I won't be able to do it at the level of justice that appears in the appendix section in the back of Bob and Sandra's book. I will at least address two key points associated with that. First one, did Jesus know what was going to transpire? He knew it all the way through. Okay. For him to come to this point then and then all of a sudden appear to be surprised that God had left him doesn't make sense and isn't consistent with the rest of the study, rest of the passages that are presented. Okay? That's one key thing there. There's no indication in any way that God, in any manner, in any other text, is being presented as having left Jesus. Okay? Now, all the way through, Jesus has said he had the power to do what, if necessary, or if he desired to. Call 12 legions of angels. Okay? He said that even in the hours preceding his death at this point. What was key standpoint of this sacrifice? It was a fulfillment, but first off, it was a fulfillment in that the sacrifice itself was completely what? Pure, without blemish. Also, that sacrifice was what? It was deity. Okay? Are we going to strip the deity of Jesus from him? And then just offer a man as a sacrifice, that would have done no good. Okay, so you think through these logical steps of this. Jesus is offering himself. Okay, he is offering the sacrifice. God is offering his deity son as a sacrifice, and they are agreeing to do this. No absence of God separating himself from doesn't make sense. Now, where have people tried to... The second point I wanted to make, where have people tried to make this change around? They've tried to make this change around and say, well, it, as from a logical standpoint, this had to happen so that the righteousness of Jesus could be imputed to people and that their sins could be placed on him. Okay, this is the Calvinistic idea of sins being transferred to Jesus. Couples with 1 Corinthians, he became sin for them. Well, how did Christ become sin for us? He became that sacrifice. Okay? When the high priest laid his hand on the scapegoat, what happened to that scapegoat? Did that goat literally become sin, or symbolically, that scapegoat acquired the sins and was taken outside and killed and sacrificed? Or, no, see, the scapegoat was allowed to go. But it was a transfer. It was symbolically a transfer. This is a symbolic transfer of sin to that for the sacrifice. Okay, I'm not trying to confuse the points here. Anybody else want to chime in on this? Much better put than I can put it. So if you didn't hear that, there's a great deal of difference between the debt that one takes on and accepting the guilt that one might take on. Jesus did not accept the guilt of the sins, but he did accept the debt and pay the debt through his sacrifice. Doug? That is used in conjunction with the statement in 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 5:21, thank you, Eric, in how that he became sin for them. And two oftentimes have been combined in the past under the Calvinistic doctrine of that Jesus had to be forsaken by God so he could take on the sin of mankind and then be sacrificed. It is. It is tied back to Psalm 22. It's a statement in reference to that as well. And it's a simpler understanding if you look at it from that standpoint as well. Triumphing over sin, but more importantly, he's triumphing over who? Satan. Okay? Does that answer your question? Okay. Okay? Right. No, I'm not. I agree. And I think the key things here is, Eric, just in response, I wasn't trying to tie together in a definitive statement that the two are completely linked. I was just pointing out that they have been linked that way in the past. The key here is tying it back to the reference of which it is a quote from. Now, just like I said before, any storyline we have is, if you create a movie, it's got a storyline, and every line's got a purpose to convey some part of the idea. Here is a quotation from Psalm 22, and the explanation about how the individual in Psalm 22 felt abandoned, but yet realized that he did have strength is very key to understanding. Jesus is now feeling, what is he feeling? He's feeling pain. To have made a statement along those lines and is an exclamation of recognition, obviously, that I'm feeling pain. And then, but he does know what? That God is going to raise him. I think that's the best way to end this class on, is the next step in this is Jesus knows what's going to transpire. He knows he's not been abandoned because what? God's going to raise him. Right. Hands, I commend them. You can't put the two together. They don't fit together. Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's any evidence that he's separated from God in a spiritual sense other than the fact that he died and he is a human, his soul is being commended into the hands of God. That's really the only separation there. That spirit will be rejoined with his body when he is raised. Okay? Well, and that's a contrivance of man, because man not understanding this passage and not having studied the passages and tying it all together created something to fit a level of doctrine that they wanted it to fit. Second Bell, thank you for your comments.